Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research conference podcast. I'm the center's director, Ann Stevens. In March of 2015, the center hosted the conference Increasing College Access and Success for Low-Income Students. This conference brought together a unique mix of researchers, policy professionals, and education leaders to discuss new research and opportunities for low-income students. In this presentation, Eric Bettinger presents his research on the impact of pre-college advising for high school students. Bettinger is an associate professor in the Stanford University School of Education.
So we're going to stay in that vein of kind of pre-college advising, and I'm going to talk for a minute, we kind of change it a little bit in terms of going from a program that is really trying to target a specific set of students to a program that's really designed to target a set of students who are much kind of less prepared in the process, and I'll talk more about it. I want to just kind of also preface it that this every time I'm in a very long RCT, it feels like it's a marathon at some point, because in the previous work that Bill and I did, Bill had two kids, I had two kids, Bridget had two kids, between the time we started the project and the time we ended the project. And this one, I have had no new kids, but it feels like it's been that long.
This project, and we're almost 4 to 5 years in it, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the reasons for that. So I'm going to skip a little bit, kind of some of this I think is going to be a theme of the day. But the one thing kind of going off of that last set of comments, as you start to think about these models of trying to outreach to students, the models are going to be very different. And one of the things I think we're lacking right now is getting together the various models and trying to think a little bit about how we piece together some of the lessons. The model that we're going to look at here is a near-peer type model. It's a model that's really trying to think about a whole school intervention. It's much more on the lines of these kinds of large trio-type programs, upward-bound type programs that are really trying to come in and have kind of this large impact and come in as kind of the premier program in that high school. In terms of the literature, I haven't done justice to the literature here. Probably the most similar ones, or probably the upward bound is probably the one that's been cited the most. And in the RCT, I mean, part of the reason why, kind of Bruce's comment earlier about there's a lot of these different programs, it's not just the texting programs, it's in the best RCT we've had today on these kind of whole school holistic programs basically found nothing at the end of the day, no impacts. And so in some sense, it sets us all up to where all of us want to find the project that perhaps actually suggests where these things are effective, but it also kind of tells us at least where we think the evidence is right now. And I think that what we might be able to do at the end of this, kind of a preview of upcoming attractions here, we're going to find some small positive impacts, particularly on a set of population that we are worried about the most in terms of higher education. But one of the things that's going to be interesting is to try to think about the dynamics. And I only have one bullet point on it, but it's going to be a bullet point that I think is going to take a good part of our discussion in trying to think a little bit about how this program interacted and whether it was a complement or a substitute for pre-existing efforts at the school. And I think that that's going to be something we come back to in the discussion. So in terms of it, as you start to think about how you would design, if you were out there designing your best program, and I think the first talk did a nice job of kind of thinking a little bit about some of the contrasts between some of these different programs, I'm just trying to present it in a slightly different way. There's a number of different ways where you could create differences. Thinking about something that was really targeted, that said, okay, these are the set of students we're interested in, here's our goals for those, or whether it's going to be a school-wide program. We're going to focus on a school-wide program where the counselors were actually told you should be focusing on a particular population, but anybody who knocks on your door, you should actually open the door for. The second one is in-school versus out-of-school. How do we want to try to time this? This is an in-school model. And then the third piece is this near-peer. And this is, I think, the most unique part of the group that we're going to be looking at here. And the program is called Advise Texas. It's part of the College Advising Corps. And the way that the College Advising Corps kind of works with students, the College Advising Corps goes in and recruits students, for example, in the community, and they try to recruit students for about a year. I think that if when people are like Peace Corps America, go to College Advising. So they try to find these kind of dynamic students. They try to target students who have graduated from some of the high schools that they've been to, or who have been to similar high schools and have similar kind of disadvantaged experiences. The advisors come in, they're there for a 1 or a 2 year period, and during that 1 to 2 year period, depending on the advisor, after that period they leave and a new advisor comes in. And we might be able to talk a little bit more about that. The hardest part here is also trying to figure out the mechanisms. And it's going to be one of the, I'm going to try to show you these kind of, I'm going to use the same strategy as the prior one to try to think about what are some of the kind of intermediate strategies and intermediate things that happen. But I feel like this is a place where I'm not going to do much justice to as well, in part because the randomization we have is really at the school level. And, you know, the advisors, when they're in the schools, have this kind of model that, you know, anything goes to have success. And we look across the different advisors and we look at the logs that they have of the different types of meetings. We have some advisors who are targeting large groups and trying to just talk as much as possible. We have other advisors who are focused on specific students and pulling those students out of class. And so as you start to think about if that delivery mechanism matters, I'm not going to be able to shed light too much light on that. And then, of course, you know, I'm going to make the argument that these RCTs are really where we want to go. I don't know that I totally believe that. I feel like there's some limitations on that, and I'll talk a little bit about how, especially when you're in a marathon, an RCT starts to lose some of its saliency. I've already mentioned it's part of the College Advising Board. The goal, their kind of stated mission is to help first-generation students, and that's their hope. Part of the reason we call this kind of beyond triage is this full school, the school model. And what we really wanted to try to see is, and part of the reason why it's taking so long is we wanted to see what happens when you're immersed in this and if it really changes the culture of the school where you see these kind of long-term impacts. Because oftentimes if you talk to kind of fellow advisors, you talk to way too many as well, but you can never talk to too many, but at the same time, when you get the same story over and over and over again, it feels like triage. You walk in and it's basically a line of students who are behind the deadlines, who are procrastinating the deadlines, and you oftentimes that's where all your accounts are. And one of the things that the College Advising Board is trying to do is try to say, how do we actually find more time with the underclassmen? And I'm not going to show you any results on the underclassmen. I'll show you some results kind of 2 years out into the program, to where now we've got juniors and seniors who've been part of the program. And then in terms of the kind of what do they do, you know, I've already mentioned the delivery mechanism, but it's all the things that we're looking at. So if you think about this kind of gauntlet of college attendance, the set of steps that either you have to complete, or we think you should probably engage in if you want to actually move to the next step. I'm going to try to show you some results on those. In terms of the marathon, this is what I mean by the marathon. So basically, we started having discussions in 2010. And really in 2009, and we convinced them to do 15 school pilot, but they wouldn't even randomize the pilot. They just wanted to see if the kind of proof of concept worked. Well, if you try your proof of concept, that already puts you a year into the project. But then what happened in 2011, they said, okay, we're going to expand 120 schools. Now, I'll come back and I'll show you that that's not what our randomized experiment's going to be. I'd love it if it was. And then one of the other problems we have is we kind of have to wait for students to grow up.
So it starts in 2011, 2012, we actually had our first year. Now, a year later, we're in good shape, but the problem is, as I started to talk about our data is not available until almost a year later. So then it puts us almost into 2014 before we actually had any of the data.
And then the fact that also we have to go to Texas every time we want to use data, it makes it a little more difficult. I really tried to get my co-author, Brent Evans, on this to accept a job in Texas just so that he could work on the project, but he didn't comply, so. What we were able to do is when they did their application process, we convinced them that they had so many slots and they had so many schools who wanted to be part of it, that they should try some kind of randomization. And this was I think I spent about 4 months of my life and I gained about at least 5 of these pounds from this process by itself, because it was really painstaking to try to help them understand. And in the end, what we found, we had about 240 applications for these 120 spots. But at the end, we kind of came up with this hybrid because they felt like they were ethically bound, morally bound in their words, to work with the schools that were most prepared. So literally, the first 84 schools, they selected based on how disadvantaged they were. So our criteria to just even get in the pool is you had to have a high value reduced lunch. 35% is not high in my, or is not as high as a lot of the most disadvantaged. Less than 70% graduates. Now the average is really around 45% in our sample. In the sample that's actually in the experiment, the sample is much lower in these 84 schools. And then less, the Texas, just like California, have these kind of distinguished some definition of a curriculum, and we have some metric of what percentage of the students were actually following that curriculum. So we had something there. There was also this qualitative fit. That one of the things that was really, really hard to get through to the staff was the staff had in mind that certain structures of school governance would be incompatible with their model altogether. And so they made this kind of qualitative fit component based on their perception of how easy it would be to work with these individuals. Now, we tried to get them away from that. We tried everything we could, but in the end, we couldn't. So in the end, these 84 schools largely were the ones they thought had the greatest fit and had the greatest need. So what was left, we threw out about 50 of the schools because the 50 schools were so far above, there was at least one of the criteria they actually hadn't complied with. And when a school has a 90% enrollment rate in college, it's hard to think that they have a strong need that this program is going to meet, especially for third generation. At the end of the day, we were able to basically have 111 schools that we ran in the lottery through, and we chose 36 of the schools. Now, that all sounds so great. I'm going to show you a slide on community here that one of the problems is the software organization. They exist because either school districts, governments, or foundations say, we believe in your model, here's the money, go do good things. And so, for example, one of the, in the first year of our program, the city of Austin said, we love this program. I'm not going to ask all of your advisors, but only if you put them in office. From their perspective, it was like, no! But from their perspective, wow, we just were able to become more sustainable. And so we're going to see that there's some real non-compliance issues that are going to come up, especially after the first year, because of things like that, donors getting involved and exerting things. Now, what we tried to do to improve our power a little bit was we tried to block the schools, and we want to block them by, for example, similar racial characteristics or similar socioeconomic characteristics. But in the end, what they will only go along with is some type of regional block, geographically. So we'll see that that's actually going to, we can, especially with only 36 on the treatment, but we get a couple of schools, as I'll show you, with kind of differences in their racial composition, we're going to wind up a little bit imbalanced here. Part of the reason they wanted the region is because the way that the model works, which is kind of a satellite model, while they have these 36 schools that were participating, these 36 schools, the Texas A&M, Texas Christian, Trinity, UT Austin, are all the schools that are basically overseeing them. And the model works as somewhat of a satellite. Texas A&M will basically be assigned a set of schools who have been selected to be in charge of. And part of the reason they wanted to, it's by region, is they didn't want a situation where the Texas A&M and their oversight capacity was driving all the way across Texas for various things. So they wanted to be clustered in a way that they could get some synergies between the regions and the trainings. Now our data, I've already kind of cursed it once. On the one hand, it's wonderful data. It's the best possible data you could have, but it's also just hard to use at times. In part because you have to show up to Texas. And Paco actually knows this all too well. You get to sit in rooms in Texas, and there is nothing like going to Texas in July and being on the third floor of the building that had in the closet that they converted to a data room without air conditioning. So I would have my walk in the building outfit and a pair of sweats and a t-shirt for the room itself. I lost weight there, and I gained it back elsewhere in the project. So what I'm going to show you, so with the data, basically, Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board worked with TEA. They've got a nice cooperative relationship where they were able to provide administrative data for all of the students. Now, we couldn't actually link their administrative data to other sources of data that we have, but at the same time, administrative records in some ways is the best we can do. Now, the one problem you get in that administrative data is we're only tracking public school enrollments in the state of Texas. And nobody's done a great simulation with this, at least I know of. If there is one that I don't know of, you can come talk to me.
One of the things we did in our other data, we have data from college advisory boards in other states, we've used the MSC data to try to say, well, let's suppose you had that restriction of only having public in-state schools. And it varies. I mean, it looks like we're about, it's about a 10 percentage point difference between the MSC metrics and the data that we have in the restriction of in-state. In these more places like California, where the data is campus applied, geographically, it's a little more isolated, there's about a 6% point difference. And so, you know, that's probably the best number that I have there in terms of what our misstatement is going to be. There's no reason to think it should be asymmetric across the treatment and control group, although the College Advisory Board suggests that they're much more open to sending students out of state, and so they claim that there might be something there. In terms of the numbers, I'm going to show you two graduating classes. The 2014 graduating class, their data is available, or at least available to me, on April 25th. So if somehow I get another invitation, you know, before this marathon's over, then I can show you that as well. And then the other thing that we were able to do is we've tried to do these treatment surveys in the treatment and control schools. And it's been very hard to get compliance in the control schools since we have no leverage there. This last year, we just put all the money that IES could give us behind this, went out there, pushed really hard, and you know, we wound up with something like 50 control schools in our entire treatment population. So I'll show you some of those, at least for the 2014 year, where we have the best coverage. Okay, lots of little numbers. These are the two numbers I want you to focus on. These are just trying to demonstrate the balance. And the numbers I want to show you is, I mentioned that we could have some racial imbalance, and we have one or two schools that are under the treatment that are kind of disproportionately different from the others in there. And what we find is that we're overrepresented in kind of the African American population relative to the control group and our treatment group. And we could go the opposite direction in terms of our Hispanic schools. We have a couple of schools that have high African American populations as well as Hispanic populations. The other thing I just wanted to kind of show you down here, if you look at the size of the average Texas school, the average senior class is about 160. In our data, it's actually around 370 in the experimental sample. In our treatment group, that's another question that's a small difference. It's about 420 students. Now, part of the reason I mention that is I want you to start thinking and formulating some actual thinking here. You have one advisor who's put in a room and basically you've got 420 students. They're in a more, you know, not the most disadvantaged in high school, 4 weeks. You know, you start to think about what you should expect. The hard part for the advisor is it'd be easy for them to know, here are the kids who want to go to college, and here are the ones who aren't going to go to college, and they don't know this. And so they're trying to play the kind of guessing game of which students are the ones who really need the help.
And so, you know, at least expectation-wise, this was one of the things that we thought, you know, we weren't sure what to expect in terms of what their impact should be. Okay, what else do I want to say here? This is more of a summary of what I just showed you, so let's skip it and go on to the next step. So here's the compliance issue.
So of the 36 schools that we had that were initially chosen, we've had five who've left the program. Three of them left because they were so geographically isolated that it was impossible for them to be serviced by any of our schools because they had a reasonable amount of training.
And they felt like there was a problem there. The other two, I can't say, you know, I think it's actually kind of fit issues, whereas as the school and the administration has started working together, they've realized that they're just incompatible with each other. The bigger problem is that of our 75 control schools, 9 of them have actually joined the program. Now, some of those are the city of Austin coming in. One of them was a donor in,
those of you who know Austin, do you know Bucky's, the truck stop? What's the town there? About Texas State, wherever that is. If you haven't been to Bucky's, you should go to Bucky's. It's like this truck stop that's like the size of a Walmart. It's
an institution. But
the donor in that city, basically came out and basically said, same deal as Austin. And he actually kind of forced it to do the control schools there.
Which, you know, I'm so appreciative of. So, you know, our guess is that the treatment untreated, our estimates would be about 1/3 higher based on our compliance rates. Well, I'm not going to show you those. I'm going to show you the intent to treat, but that's what we think would happen. Okay, so let me walk through and show you some main impacts. So in the very first one here, model one here, where I want to focus your attention. So in 2012, the very first year, we found a 2 percentage point increase. But by the next year, it actually dropped down to about 1.3 percentage points. and average it out at one point, somewhere around 1.8 percentage points, and it loses its significance. It kind of flirts with us in different models. But the number we get is around 2%, but it's fragile, and it disappears at one point around 1.5 percentage points. In particular, the two-year cycle, we actually see more enrollments happening there than in 4 years. And so, you know, in terms of, like, overall impact, like, it's a, somewhere around a 1.8 to 2% point impact on the school level, but it's fragile. When you pool the data, it all looks like there's something going on at the 2 year, but not much else going on here. Now, that's in the overall population, but as I mentioned, these are large schools, and so when you look at the subgroups, that's where some of the action actually comes out a little bit more. So, for example, the populations that we think are probably most indicative of their mission, this first generation, are low-income students. We wind up actually having a significant impact there, about a 3%, 2.5 to 3%, which this is the pool data across both years. And then in the Hispanic population as well, it winds up being about a 2 percentage point impact across both of the years, and it's very robust across the model. Our African-American population, we actually didn't find anything. The overall treatment looks like it's positive, but then the interaction with African-American those two and then in terms of our other populations, once you've actually tried to think about whether there's differential impacts, we don't find much. What we do find is that basically for males, we're actually seeing something that looks like the program actually works. I'll come back and we can talk a little bit more about what we think is happening. And this bottom panel, I mean,
I don't know exactly everything I'll answer. There's too many numbers, so that's a problem.
As you look at the Hispanic one sticks around no matter what we do. The low-income one sticks around, but it's really located in the four-year sector. So we see this kind of pre-reduced launch case where making it to four-year college. When we said a set of Hispanic students who are making with an African-American population, every time we do something, the interaction kind of negates it altogether. If there is any action, it's happening in the two-year sector there, but that's all we have. So just the summary of the results. More likely to enroll. Impact on Hispanic students. Those are kind of our big two subgroups we're seeing. The African-American students may be less likely, but there's not a big story here. And then also, we're not getting much in terms of the female students relative to those. The kind of differential effect here that we have in the slide isn't what I think is the most interesting of the points here. So let me go and talk about the survey. So, you know, did this survey I mentioned. It was 42 control schools who actually did it in practice, 50 schools said they would do it, 42 complied with it. And then basically in our treatment schools, we had 36. One of the things that happened was that some of those original 84 schools, that they fell out of those, and they wanted to bring them in the university to do additional lottery. So our lottery sample was 36 in our first year, but in 2014 we were able to add back about 5 more schools to additional lotteries. Now, in those schools, I'm going to only show you the results for the seniors. It looks pretty good, except for just like we saw the kind of balance between Hispanics and African Americans. We replicate that in our survey data. In terms of the numbers, why do I have the same bullet points over and over? That's smart. I'm just going to give you the kind of broad level. Here's our numbers. So the first one is, this is something to stop talking. You ask them what they want to do. They say, the students who are at this junior school are basically saying they want to actually get more education, less likely to say that they're planning on working full-time in this in April, so this is about their September plans. When you look at things like, the kind of soft things like, did you visit the college, did you actually go to this place or that, you see they're actually very similarly likely to engage in those types of activities. But then when you start to get into the harder applications, or the harder outcomes, like how many applications did you submit, did you take these exams, did you file the FAFSA, or are you about to finish it? And again, those are self-reported. The one that I found was interesting was more likely to have completed a deposit than we've seen self-reported data in these schools. Then this last point, which I mentioned at the very beginning, I said it's a single bullet point, but it's actually a very important point. One of the things when you ask them who they talk to about it, you see the kind of jump you would expect in terms of talking to a person. But what you see is a significant drop in the likelihood that they talk to a high school counselor.
And what you see in the control schools is kind of, it stays high, but there's still talking to the high school counselors. So in these programs, you see that those discussions with the high school counselors and the seniors are both on the rise. And it's an interesting thing to kind of think about here, because we talked about substitutes, and we've already talked about many other access programs that students have the ability to go to. And we were really attuned to that in our survey, and we found that this program had generated more visits than those other alternative programs they had at the school. But then, when we talked about the school resources themselves, we saw this significant shift in the advising course schools that dropped, and in the other schools that continued to stay at a high level. And what it helped us, at least identify to the college advising board is, at least from the school's perspective, the school's using this at least as a substitute in terms of further programming rather than as a complement. And if you think about the combination of those types of things, the fact that we start to have less statistical power as we move forward because of the fact that our compliance is going down, that secondary result started to tend towards zero, makes even more sense in the context of you've got less of a kind of treatment control context, and we have greater kind of substitution going on with
increased less use of the high school counselors as a resource. So the kind of business as usual isn't even becoming an add-on, it's becoming a replacement. So this is my last slide. I don't think given the size, given some of the concerns I had about compliance and the substitutability, it's not surprising there's not big effects, but at least on the inframarginal students, it looks like something's happening there. And we do have this kind of consistent results across the free reduced lunch and the Hispanic population in Texas. This kind of degree of complementarity, I think it becomes part of the story in terms of as we start to think about these holistic programs, how do these holistic programs really interface in a meaningful way with school? And are we just basically subsidizing the school to divert attention? Now, I want to be sensitive to high school counselors. I mean, if you look across the caseload that high school counselors had, but in the control school, we see, is there somehow able to stretch themselves to cover that? Whereas in the treatment schools, we don't know how the counselors are spending the time that they now have free. If they're spending their time in some productive way, it could be that it's generating impacts, but we don't have the metrics on those ones to see exactly what those counselors are doing now that they have extra time. In the worst case scenario, you can imagine if it were subsidizing just that they're taking home less work, their satisfaction goes up, but I'm not sure that that's why donors have wound up to do. So other stuff we have to do, we've got some work to do on the cost-benefit analysis. We've got good information on in terms of all the costs, and as we're trying to think through exactly what those benefits are and get a metric. I think the one thing I would put here as future work is just the hardest thing in this entire research, and the reason I think it's partly a marathon, is literally you come home with the data and you look at the graph and you say, wow, I need to understand this. And then you say, oh, but I can't go back to Texas until this time. And I can't get that variable until this time. And so basically this is like the ultimate like 6-month project. Every December I did think about a bunch of regressions in the government, and then in April I did it again, and in the summer, my co-author and I just going to that hot room.
So hopefully, we have some more results to show you as we go. But let me stop there, and I'll look for questions, and hopefully in the Q&A, I can bring out some of the institutional details that we're in the process.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.